was eerily quiet. And then my mind was kind of like, you know, the head in the fishbowl.
But it takes me into the bathroom and says, this is how you brush your teeth. Brush, rinse, repeat. Brush, rinse, repeat. Brush, rinse, repeat.
But there were two girls. And it was like, you'll have to give us a ride. You can't tell us no. He can't refuse us. He'll let us in his car.
The thoughts were all alone in this empty void. You know, the head in the fishbowl.
It just doesn't look right.
They got close enough where he said he could see, you know, their eyes
and how intelligent they seem.
This doesn't look right.
These gremlin type creatures.
This doesn't look right.
No pupils, no iris, three fingers, three long fingers. And this is when the mental torture.
And then it was eerily quiet.
Welcome back to Conspiranormal, guys. This is your friendly host, Adam.
Friendly is relative, bro.
Friendly's relative? Yeah, it's all relative, man.
He's your friendly relative.
How you doing, Mr. Rob?
I am wonderful. Festival season is upon us. I'm trying not to get stressed out. I'm gonna burn.
Center yourself.
Yes, that's right. I'm gonna find my happy place.
Your chi?
My power animal, or what was that?
It's a squirrel.
Your squirrel, yes. Yeah. Ross been battling the Illuminati squirrels lately. Serfiel, how you doing, man? I understand you dug up a crypt today.
Yeah, I was disappointed. We didn't find anything.
You didn't find any Masonic imagery down there or anything?
No, just some old concrete slabs.
Okay, I gotcha. Well, guys, we're going straight into the guests as we've been doing the last few shows, and I'm excited about this one because we're going to talk tonight. We gave a little bit of a preview last time with Tom and Jenny from 13 O'Clock Podcast, but we're going to talk about the Smiley Face Killer, or killers. And we have on the line a repeat guest, William Ramsey, and also a new guest, Jim Smith. Guys, welcome. William, welcome back to Conspiranormal. Jim, welcome to Conspiranormal.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Jim, we haven't had you on before, as I said, so I'd like to kind of get you a little bit of your background and kind of what brought you into this interest of researching this phenomenon of the Smiley Face Killer.
That's an interesting question. I learned about this, I guess probably about 14 years ago, to be honest with you. I was fresh out of college, and I'm from Georgia, and I went to work in Minnesota for a couple months. And I learned about this by accident, literally sitting in the hotel lobby and there being a story on the morning news about to go to work in this hotel lobby with packed full of people about the third young man they had found in the river up there. And I had actually just been shown the same part where the guy was found by a coworker. What was showing me around Minneapolis and how beautiful it was. And that's the first time I learned about this and thought it was interesting. A couple years later, it really blew up on the TV, and I saw Professor Gilbertson and Detective Gannon on Fox News, and they were talking about all these young men and the Smiley Face Killer, and that was the first time I had heard anybody ever use that term.
And William, how about yourself? How did this become an interest for you?
Yeah, thanks again. I had you. I was on mute, so I apologize. But thanks for having me back on your show, Adam.
Absolutely, sir.
Adam. So anyway, but I became interested in the topic while researching my last book, which was Children of the Beast. It was about Aleister Crowley and all the people he influenced in the 20th century. And I kept seeing all these smiley faces pop up from a variety of different people. People like Alan Moore and a guy by the name of Genesis P. Orridge, who was in kind of an occult influence band. And so from that is what kind of led me into just kind of interwoven with this notion of smiley face killers, which I'd heard about. I kind of understood that, you know, this kind of events had happened in the past. And I wanted to kind of figure out, was this happening now? And so probably early 2016 was when I really started researching. And the first case that came across was a guy by the name of Joey LaBute, out of Columbus, Ohio, and he disappeared out of a bar in the short north part of the northern part of the downtown area. And I said to myself, this guy shows up in water, it's going to be just like one of these other cases. And about 19 days later, he showed up dead in the Scioto River in a kind of a very place where there really wasn't any current. It was an eddy outside of the main river. And I was like, okay, this is one of these types of cases. And that's really where I hit the ground running. And over the 2016 is when I kept running into this guy on Twitter, Smiley Face Colt. I didn't know who it was, but, you know, and I've run it. There's other research as well, but Jim, and that's how I kind of met Jim, was just kind of through a slow process of him and I realizing these cases were happening at the same time. And so that's how he became the main researcher on the documentary Smiley Face Killers, who was abducting, torturing, and murdering college-age men in the U.S. and U.K.
So what is a typical example of one of these cases? What usually happens in one of these?
Typically, it's always been a young man. And Jim brought up the first researchers, who are Gannon and Gilbertson. And Gannon had a partner named Duarte out of New York. And they really wrote the seminal book, which is Case Studies in Drowning Forensics. But it's always the younger man out late at night, almost exclusively. Like, all these cases are all happen at night, maybe with a few exceptions. But the main general the MO is out late at night, disappeared, usually missing for a longer time than he should have been found, and then found in water. Maybe, some of us are just as short as the next day, but usually it's an elongated amount of time past when they should have found it. And oftentimes, probably at least 10 and 20 cases that I can name off the top of my head, the young men are found in a place already searched, either by sonar, by land. I mean, literally searched. And you can watch it, and you've seen the movie. Mm-hmm. You can see that they have the underwater teams on people like Wilkins and some of these other cases. Wilkins out of Bristol, UK, where they're clearly, looking in the air pond, and then he shows up, 2 weeks later. So those are what would be styled the smiley face killer phenomenon, and it's associated, got that name because some of these cases, the early researchers found typically it would be a spray painted smiley face of some style or nature close to it, and Jim and I have talked about it. We've come to think that it's kind of a semi-misnomer. I mean, even though the smiley faces are associated with the cases, you could take that kind of imprint away, and these cases would still fit that same type of phenomenon.
Sure, right. And disappear. Right, yeah, agreed. What's the age range usually of some of these victims?
Jim?
What's the low end and what's the high end?
I debate this with people a lot. I mean, I've seen cases that I could show each one of you guys where the youngest is, there's been a handful of 13 and 14 year old young kids. But most people think it's just college age kids, but a majority is between 18 and I would say 35 is the majority, but you will find some people on the older end. And the earliest, you never see children ever, but 13 I've seen a couple times, 14, 15 a couple times, 16 a couple times, but 17, 18 through up to 35 is the most.
Okay. So in the documentary, I noticed that there weren't anybody, I would think under the age of 18 was included. Was that a choice to not include those, or?
I had to, really, one of the challenges of looking at these cases is really parsing through a far larger pool than the ones even I put in the film. So I really wanted to focus on cases that have been studied by Gannon and Gilbertson and the recent cases. But all of those cases that I had in my, to a T, all were found in water. So this is like, I covered probably 40 or 50 people found in water, but there's clearly could be even a larger pool of potential victims, not from the same type of killer. I narrowed it down to this MO being learned and distributed through the internet throughout the world. So that's why I believe that these cases all have those similar characteristics.
Okay. What's the general geographic area of the country that these cases are falling in?
I mean, it's usually in bodies of water. So there's actually a lot of cases, and Jim really opened my eyes to this, is a lot of cases in California. There was a lot of cases recently in Oregon, Portland, even up to Vancouver or Washington, that have not really been put into the kind of research pool that other researchers have looked into. But I would say that they're typically in college-age towns. There's definitely hot zones. New York, Boston was incredible. Was
really Lacrosse.
Incredible. Lacrosse, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Minnesota. And then it's happening in the UK. And the more that I've studied, there was just a recent case out of Poland. There was another one in Hamburg. So it's happening all over in the UK as well. I mean, it's just if you keep, there was a guy by the name of Piotr Kajanka who was missing for 2 months in Poland. And then Liam Colgan was a man from the UK who disappeared in Hamburg, who was missing 10 weeks, searched for over and over again, and then found in the river. So it's hard to say. In my documentary, I include similar cases that happened in Spain, even Thailand. So it's hard to, and there's Canada too. Jim knows a lot about Canada cases as well.
Okay. So it's, even though you had so many cases in the film, you probably would have made like the movie probably would have been like a week long if you included right. everything.
Yeah. No doubt. I had to excise a lot of information. I mean, I tried to be as information dense as possible for the documentary, but I really feel like there's at least another 3.5 hour movie to be made, if not two more, because of all the other cases that have happened in just even recently.
And Jim, I'm sorry, I stepped over you there. What were you going to say?
I was just commenting on what William was saying, just about Canada. Like Canada has been very active this year.
Really?
Very. Yes.
Okay. So the one thing I kind of want to get out of the way, and we pitched this to our guest last week. They have a podcast that deals a lot with true crime and with some paranormal stuff as well. But that's some of their specialty on the podcast. And we asked them about it. And they were kind of the opinion that this is kind of like a statistical anomaly. That it young men get drunk, they fall into a river, and they eventually wash up. So what would be the case to make the case that that is not what it is, that there actually is something more nefarious going on?
That's a good question. William, you want to go first?
Sure. Well, I would say that I tried to show conclusively, and I think I did in the documentary, that not all the victims are drunk. You know, if you look at some of these people, they're clearly, whether it's Kelleher's walking upright, whether it's some of these other guys, William Hurley's not drunk. You know, some of these other guys are Zach Marr. They're clearly upright. So and they supposedly drowned, especially these cases out of Boston. The St. Charles River is basically a pond. There's a dam there, basically a lock that keeps the tide from, I mean, the current from moving. So you have to think that these guys somehow were able enough to walk close enough to the water and then lose consciousness and drowned in some of these very still areas. So I think that, you know, Dakota James is another example, a case out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where they have pictures of him walking and texting at the same time. And this guy, he disappeared for 40 days. Where was he 40 days? To standard, yeah. And these are pretty objective scientific facts, that if a body drowns, typically it'll surface 3 to 7 days, except in extremely cold weather. And on the coldest of weather, somewhere between 20 days. So why is Dakota James missing for 40 days? So I think that there's a lot of cases that the evidence clearly shows that they're not fully incapacitated by alcohol.
Sure. Jim, you have anything to add to that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I love being asked that question because you know, the evidence is out there. I mean, look no further than my Twitter account and what I've been doing for 4 years and about how many missing cases that I immediately tweet out or post about men that have vanished and how I will say this guy's going to be found in water. And over and over and over and over and over and over again, the men are found in water. The proof is up. The tweets are up. I mean, I'm not making it up. You can look for yourself. But that's just one example. Another example is, you know, men who are missing like Dakota James for 40 days and have only been deceased for a couple days.
Right.
No explanation. Right. Or, you know, the taunting signs on social media. There are cases where men are making cryptic tweets or Facebook posts unexplained. Men who are great swimmers, sober, lifeguards, who drown, you know, or areas that are searched over and over and over again with sonar and dogs and divers.
Dakota James is a perfect example, because I showed in my documentary that the police were asked right there in the conference when they found his body, when was it searched? And they said, just this last weekend. I think he showed up on a Monday morning. So I suspect his body was put in there Sunday night, a very quiet time, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Has anyone ever encountered anyone throwing a body in? Has there been any witnesses that have said that they saw somebody that was suspicious around the area and then afterward the body was found?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay. Yes. There have been cars. There have been vans in cases. You know, not necessarily as much, but there have been cars caught doing strange things before a young man has been abducted.
That's true. What is it? Anthony Urena?
Urena, they had two cars. You know, he starts walking down an alley. And I mean, these people are smart. These are not dumb criminals. These people are being taught a protocol to follow. And they know where the cameras are. It's not by accident that these people are being caught. I mean, people disappear right out of, as soon as CCTV is out of range and people are gone, never seen again. been cars caught. But again, nobody's investigating. No one's following up. No one's getting the footage. There's a lot more is out there, but they're never going to find it.
That's a great point, Jim, because in my documentary, I bring up the case of this one homosexual killer by the name of Port, who was using GHB, and they found that he was tied to at least four deaths. But when they went back through, they found out he was involved in long-term criminality that involved dozens of young men. But the only reason he got caught is the family demanded to see the CCTV, and they asked the police, who is that guy with my brother? And the police didn't even know. So that's just, and now there was an inquest in UK. The results actually, I think, have come out within the last month or so about the incompetence of the police in dealing with that case. And Port was highly suspicious. He killed people and dumped them in the same church ground, and nobody thought that that was suspicious. So there's all, I mean, I think that's an exemplar of what's possibly happening. Well, I think it's an exemplar of the larger issue of what's happening with these young men's deaths.
So let's talk about some of the first cases. When are these first cases? And I want to particularly focus on a couple that were in New York City. Cases where pretty much the two men, their bodies ended up in the same area.
Right. That was Patrick McNeil. And do you remember the other guy's name, Jim?
Falcon.
Falcon, yeah. Adam, so they were both in the water treatment facility.
Yeah. So many. I know what cases you're talking about. That's also another common theme, is that the same areas have multiple victims. You know, there's been others in that same area, Adam, that you were talking about. In fact, Anthony Urena, that we were just talking about with the cars, he was found in the same area 10 years later, you know?
Yeah, the Patrick McNeil case is often, I refer to it, and I think somebody else did, as victim zero, one of the earliest victims. College student, I think he went to, you know,
NYU.
NYU or something like that.
This is 1997?
Yeah, 97. Okay. Was walking down the street. Witnesses saw him vomiting, incapacitated. A car was following him. He disappeared, ended up in the water treatment facility down the Hudson River in New York Bay or whatever it is over there, downstream. And it took like 5 or 10 years for the family to obtain the autopsy report. When they did, and this is all detailed in case studies and forensic drownings, when they did obtain it, they found out that their son had been tortured with what looked like a blowtorch on his upper body. And there was evidence that showed that he had been restrained, you know, so like he was in a chair or something like that. So, that's a remarkable case.
Adam Falcon was the other gentleman.
A year later, right? Almost a year later.
Today, yes. Yeah.
And what was the specifics on his case?
it's hard to remember exactly because there's so many cases, but he was a New York student, was on the soccer team, was last seen at a bar, you know, a superb athlete, very smart, you know, upper echelon just of young men, and vanished from a bar out and found in the river, pretty much very close, I believe, pretty close to where McNeil was. Who, that's again, that's what they call him, victim number one. I tend to disagree a little bit with that. I mean, I've seen a couple cases in the early 90s that are the exact same. Not very many, but it seemed to really explode in 1997-98.
I wonder what was going on then that made that happen.
Well, I think that it was the advent of kind of the internet taking shape, communications, that stuff like that. I think that there's something going on with those types of some type of communication through, you know, message boards or something like that.
There's also a big cluster of them in Boston. I want to talk about some of these cases as well, because you make a lot of good points about those in the documentary, William.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, the Boston cases are remarkable. That's definitely a nexus point. There's been very recent cases, notably Zach Marr and a guy by the name of Kelleher, both close to downtown. There was another one that was William Hurley was a notable case. But there's a whole bunch of others. But the Zach Marr case is pretty disturbing. He's out at a bar in, I think it was one of the oldest bars, if not the oldest bar in downtown Boston. There's just reports that are different. He said he told his family that the bouncers wouldn't let him back in. Mm. The restaurant disputes that and supposedly walks over and drowns in the same area that they find the body of Kelleher and Hurley, which is... was it the St. James River? But that, you know, that's a very suspicious case. Another missing for a longer time. Kelleher was the same thing. He was last seen at Paul Revere Park on the north side of the river. After his cell phone. Game. Yeah, after the Boston Celtics game, there's pictures of him walking. He's fine. His cell phone pinged south of the river, last seen going south, and then disappears. And then somehow his body is found back north again. So yeah, there's a lot of cases in Boston.
Which was the one where the girlfriend was literally right around the corner, Hurley, had just William spoken Hurley. To him? Okay. And she had just spoken to him on the phone, and then he is just gone.
Yeah.
Right. I think this was the one where the cell phone was smashed. We found the cell phone smashed.
Yes. Yeah. There's been a bunch, you know, what you were just saying too about Zach Marr was that when Kelleher immediately went missing, the first place the Boston Police Department started searching with sonar and boats every day was exactly where Zach Marr was found dead.
Mm. Yeah, and I show in the documentary the background of, you know, what the river looks like. It's basically a lake. So, you know, it's kind of silly. Another one of the cases that I include, Jim and I went through one time in our talks and gave a top 20 or top 10 cases. And one of mine was another one out of Boston by the name of Franco Garcia that we have a lot of evidence about. He was seen on a CCTV walking upright. So not drunk, not slobbering, disappeared. They checked the reservoir over by the college that he went to. The reservoir was checked. You can see it in my movie. They're checking the reservoir. And then they find his body. Somebody, a jogger, is able to find his body later in the same reservoir that was checked from the sidewalk. So I think that's a very important case to show that these guys are not drunk. They're not stumbling into the water.
Yeah, and it's very odd because you have very still water. And you have this section where they're speaking to his parents and his mother. I guess she makes this comment that I believe my son is alive somewhere, but you can see the water in the background and it's very still. And you can see that there's all these people out there searching for him. It doesn't seem like it's that big of an area to be searching because you're in the middle of a city.
Yep.
No, there was a huge search. You know, they were out giving out flyers. It's very common in a lot of these cases because the families don't see that this is part of a pattern. They all go out. They get huge search parties. They put out flyers and pamphlets through all these poles, you know, on all kinds of utility poles. Same thing happened with Zach Marr. And, you know, they don't know. But I think for me that the mother, there was such a heartrending statement by her that I included it twice in a very long documentary. But I included it twice because I think that she intuitively keyed into what was happening without ever doing a, you know, a kind of expansive study like I, you know, me and Jim have both done.
And how many days between when he was disappeared and then when he was found?
I'd have to look that up. I can't remember. I think it was, let me see, Franco Garcia.
It was over 2 weeks.
Okay, 2 weeks. That's a long time.
Oh yeah, he should have. You know, they should have been able to find his body before then.
I mean, that's a great thing you bring up too. You know, there's a lot of studies about, it's pretty much science about the temperature of the water and how when a body decomposes and if it's actual drowning victim and about a timetable about when people actually surface.
Yeah,
and it goes against all that.
Franco Garcia disappeared February 21st, 2012. His body was found on April 11th, 2012. So roughly 40 days, which, you know, 50 days. So he was missing for a long time.
Wow. Okay. So almost 2 months.
And there is a kind of, unfortunately, a lot of the autopsies have not been made public. You know, they're not public. So you don't know what the state of the bodies are in. And some people have disputed, how do you know all these bodies or people are tortured? Well, if they're being kept somewhere, without, you know, being able to leave, they're being tortured. So they may not be physically tortured, but I don't want to give away the kind of closing part of my documentary, but, you know, there is, yeah, these people, I think a lot of these people are being held alive.
I have evidence of, from families who have given me autopsies, or who have spoken to me about trauma on victims, severe trauma that's not reported by the police or the media. That is absolutely confirmed. Or other times where, again, men haven't been deceased for as long as they've been missing, or they don't have any water in their lungs, but yet they drowned.
Which, if they were in water, there should be water in their lungs. That would make sense. For sure. Yeah.
If you actually drowned in water, the reaction that you're having to drowning is to inhale, right? Because you're not having it. So you should have water in your lungs.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, there's one case, like there's another with Naz Rahimi, Muhammad Rahimi, kind of close to where Jim is. He was a perfect example of somebody who'd been beat up, you know, he was in bad shape.
Alcohol.
Yeah, no alcohol, found in a river. Super sketchy story of the people around him.
That was the one case in the documentary that was in Atlanta, Jim. Have there been any others in your area?
Oh, very many. A lot. Over 40.
Wow.
Yes. Young men. I mean, we've had, up until recently, we have 3 young men missing here right now.
It's interesting you bring up that number, Jim, because in the last episode of Conspiranormal, the guests said, oh, there's 30 or 40 cases. And in the Discovery ID show that recently covered the Smiley Face Killers, they both said the same thing. Well, we've studied 35 or 40 cases. That's way, way too low. There's so many more cases than that. It's at least 200 to 150.
Oh, yeah. There's 40 in Atlanta, 40 in Minnesota. 40 in New York, 40 in Chicago,
60 in Sydney. There's cases all over, and that I didn't even touch in Australia. There's problems in Amsterdam,
Pittsburgh, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle. Yeah. I mean,
there's 5 bodies they've never found in San Francisco. The young men are missing, but I think the water there, something really.
They've been in the ocean there in San Francisco. California 5 is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
All young men, they all look the same, all disappeared downtown by the wharf.
Yeah, so it's a that number is way too low. I mean, I'm saying 150. That's conservative.
Oh, def more.
So Minnesota and Wisconsin also seems to be a cluster, as you guys said before. Yeah, and there's one case that is particularly, I think, one of the eeriest ones. And I wanted to ask you about another one that that I didn't hear you guys talk about, but the case of Todd Guybe, 2005. I mean, this is really unsettling.
Yeah, Western Michigan.
Yeah, Michigan.
That's the one.
Yeah,
yeah, that's Western Michigan. That's one where they found the smiley face. He was at a party. Yeah, that's disturbing. That was one where they almost caught the perps. You know, I think that there was like evidence of a boat. He was found in the middle of a lake.
Yeah, leaving a party. That's in case studies in drowning forensics. Gilbertson and Gannon go in detail and talk about the he was lived near Half Moon Lake. That's another.
Yeah, there were a couple cases over there. Yeah.
So I pulled something.
And there was up. That one case, Jim. You noted, which I didn't put in the documentary, was Finnerty. Was another. He was what, a top class, a B class football
NFL quarterback.
Yeah, quarterback. Yeah,
really.
Pretty Western. That was Western Michigan. Yeah, but Guybe was the curious one because something like 2 years after he died, they found a smiley face on his gravestone.
Yeah. That was interesting. And like I said, very unsettling. But
Adam, you know, I tried to discount the involvement of the smiley face in these deaths, and I couldn't discount it because I found them in some of these other cases. Zach Marr, somebody found one. Deacon Wilkins. It's recent cases. So, and all spray painted, believe, you know, so it's all spray painted stuff. But I kind of went through an exhaustive, and within an exhaustively researched documentary, I went through and showed all of these occult references of the smiley face, you know, that are around. So it is something that's used in acid house music and this kind of underground. And still to this day, you'll see it on celebrities and people like that wearing iconography like that.
Well, I wanted to read this about the Todd Guybe case. This paragraph here, I pulled this up. I did a search on him today. And this Casanova, Michigan.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Rob, are you familiar with that place? You're from Western Michigan, right?
Is that Western Michigan?
Yeah.
Nope. Never heard of it.
Rob's from Manistee, so I don't know if that's close to where he's from or not. I think he's close to Grand Rapids. So, Guybe was last heard from during a series of cell phone calls between 12:47 a.m. and 12:57 a.m. on Sunday. At 12:47 a.m., he called the friend who had driven him to the party to say that he'd had enough and was walking home. He then called a friend at 12:51 a.m., but all he said was, "I'm in a field," before the phone call cut off. The friend called back and heard only what she thought was either breathing or the wind before the call ended. The phone was then used twice over the next few minutes in an attempt to call the friend back, with the last attempt ending at 12:57 a.m. Guybe's phone was not used again after that, neither were his credit cards. And then it said the area where Guybe was last seen was thoroughly searched three times. During one of the searches, an estimated 1,500 volunteers as well as aircraft searched the area around the party site. Nothing was found. And then 3 weeks later, on July 2nd, 2005, Todd Guybe's body was discovered in a remote pond near the party. It was reported, according to the couple who found Todd, he was standing upright in Open Hill Lake. They remember it distinctly because his head and shoulders were sticking out of the water. With a blood alcohol content of 0.12, the cause of death was ruled drowning. The manner of death was ruled undetermined. And the Michigan police closed the case. So in that one, there's actually kind of a, you almost have a witness to it because he's on the phone.
Right.
There's been other cases like that where victims call. I can think of multiple cases where the victims are calling family late at night. That's in a taunting manner, and people hang up. Something happens to them. They hang up. There was a guy in Minnesota or Wisconsin, and a gentleman was dropped off, and he called his wife, and he left a 2-minute voicemail of him screaming.
Yeah, that's Henry McCabe.
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys about that one. I noticed that I was thinking that that was going to make the documentary, but was there a reason you guys left that water. One? Yeah,
he did. He wasn't young enough. I mean, he could have gone in. there's a lot of people who kind of, he could have gone in, Finnerty could have gone in. I literally just tried to make it. I got to the point where it was just too long.
That area was searched too. I mean, bring that up. I mean, there's documented evidence by his family that that area where he was found in the water was searched multiple times.
Finnerty or McCabe or both, actually, right?
Both McCabe and Finnerty. But
Finnerty was found actually fairly close to Manistee, probably 15 miles away. I think it was Reed City or something like that.
Finnerty called his wife in a panic, saying that two men were chasing him. And this is a guy that's 6'4", 250. He's the biggest victim I've ever seen. But I believe him that somebody was chasing him.
He was found face down. Yeah.
Not far from a road. You know, his phone pinged 11 miles north from where he was.
That's right.
Pretty impossible.
Joey LeBeau was another one. He sent some cryptic text that they said it was garbled, but his family, it was like G-S-T-I-O-N or something like that. So, you know, there's been these strange activity among these cell phones of some of the victims.
How about Mason Cox and David Wood here in Atlanta? They were two best friends near New Year's partying on Lake Lanier. They vanished. They were found a week later in the same area where they were. They both drowned. They both had trauma. And the last post on Mason Cox's Facebook page, I have a picture of it. When they went missing, at the exact same time they went missing, said, "I'm not afraid of death. I'm curious of what's next."
Kind of crazy.
Whoa. What's going on?
That's not my house.
That's me.
That must be something with LA, man, because one of our good friends, Greg Bishop, he's in LA. He always talks about sirens going on when he does his show. So,
that happens.
But
there's one again. There it goes. That's two cops.
Uh-oh. It's LA.
I muted it.
Well, it sounds like that in Nashville too, so I don't want to worry about too much. There's constant sirens going on around here too. Well,
at least it's not a ghetto bird. You know what a ghetto bird is?
What's a ghetto bird?
That's a chopper who's chasing down one of these cars that's on on escaping. They call it a ghetto bird because it just flies over. Yeah, it flies over LA. That's kind of an urban term for a chopper.
I was curious, William. I wanted to ask you this because is there, you know, being someone that, you know, you look into a lot of esoteric stuff, is there a ritual significance to these guys being put into water?
I think so. I think it's very similar to a lot of different cases, and my studies have indicated that you can ritually drown somebody. And I've come at it from a variety of things. It's actually similar to what happened in West Memphis 3. Two of the young boys were drowned. I do think that there, at least in some of these cases, something like that there is some occult aspect to some of these cases. And I think I showed that in the documentary, like some of these people are clearly occultists. And I definitely think that there's something there. Yeah.
And there was this is Serfiel. You said there's some victims who displayed that they might have been tortured with a blowtorch.
Well, at least one. The guy that I talked about was McNeil, but there was a couple other. Tommy Booth was another one. I don't think he had a blowtorch. He had scars of like somebody put out a cigarette on his hand, and I think he had broken teeth. But he was another one who disappeared out of a bar, and really a sketchy background. That was one of the case studies in forensic drowning cases where he had told his family, like, "I'm hanging out with sketchy people. I want to get away from them," and then he turns up in a place again previously searched. It looks like his body had been dragged and he had clearly been beat up or something had happened to him. But the time of death, I think Gannon and Gilbertson ascertained the time of death was sometime within the last 24 hours, and he was missing for 8 or 9 days.
Because there is the concept of, ancient Celtic origins of the threefold death, which would be three elemental ways of dying. Like, so if someone was burned with a blowtorch, you have fire, and then they were obviously drowned or put into water. Maybe that might have something to do with some of that.
Well, it's definitely, if you look at some of the stuff that I've researched, Kenneth Anger and Lucifer Rising, they're clearly drowning personified human beings in water. There's all kinds of ritual things that's going on that I can't say I fully understand, but some people have tied it into, you know, this whole thing within Antinous and the Emperor Hadrian, the Roman Emperor, who either ritually drowned or killed his gay lover in the Nile. And so, you know, there might be something strange and esoteric or occult like that. It's hard to say the totality of what these people are thinking, but I do think that most of these crimes have a strong homosexual bent. You know, they're not financial crimes. None of these people ever have their money stolen or anything like that. So something else is going on. So it's clearly something else is going on. If that's where, it's kind of interesting because it doesn't seem like anybody's emphasized that on these smiley face killers, that these are all good looking, healthy young men. You know,
so is there any autopsy information that has come forward that would suggest sexual abuse?
Not to my knowledge. Okay. Although I think on the Dakota James case, they got that famous. Here comes another police officer. They got the famous forensic pathologist Cyril Wecht is supposedly working on that case. I don't know if he's finished his own independent autopsy yet, though. Hold on, just a sec.
That's the national.
Something's going on.
There's never been an. I've never seen anything to say that there's sexual assault. Talking to victims' families or any cases I've ever read.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I have no. There's no evidence. I can't think of anything that's evidence that they were. There's evidence of sexual assault. Doesn't mean there isn't any. You know what I mean?
Right, and so, it doesn't have to be traditional. You know, mm-hmm. If it's a sexual nature, of course, it doesn't have to be in these type of situations, the traditional sexual acts. I mean, there's torture and all kinds of things that can be sexualized to some of these people. So
there was somebody brought this to my attention, a very interesting case that's out of Australia. And it was, I can't believe it, but there's another police car coming through. So there must have been a huge accident.
We got some serious action going on. Yeah,
something
on
here is tonight. Definitely going down.
Yeah.
That's like the sixth one. I can't believe it. There was an interesting case that was out of Adelaide in Australia, and they called it the family murders. And the reason they did is because there was abductions of young men centered around. They only busted this one guy. His name was, he had a German name. It was like Balder Vaughn something. The family in Adelaide, but they had killings of young men, even some young boys, 14 or 15 year old. But they were taken and sexually tortured. They were missing for a period of time. And the bodies were placed all over Adelaide. And only one person got caught. But there were other witnesses who saw people driving around in a car, that he was with other people. And there were other kind of not elite, but doctors and other people who were implicated in the family, but never got convicted. Only one guy did. And that case, I think, is probably something very similar to what's going on. It's interesting, too, that you... On your last podcast, you talked about Herb Baumeister and the supposed ghost at his place. But this is a homosexual killer as well, who, you know, they don't know the totality of how many people he killed, but he had at least 20 bodies or something like that, right?
Wow. What?
You there?
Yeah, we're here.
Yellow. Okay. Well, like Herb Baumeister. So, you know, these are tying.
Yeah. I mean, they found, I think they said that they were like 11 bodies possible total. But they were scattered throughout the entire property, so they don't know honestly how many it could have been. And at the same time, Baumeister was going on. There was also this I-70 killer that was killing all these people, and it was all around the same area of Indiana and Ohio. And they've always thought that Baumeister might have had something to do with that, but I think it turned out to be another guy, but it really makes you think that, you know, obviously in these cases, if it's happening throughout the country and in the UK and throughout the world, that you're dealing with like a whole network of people that are doing this.
Yeah, I did. I'd never have thought that it was one independent core. It's groups and individuals. You know, my conclusion is that it's an MO that people have learned. So, you know, Baumeister, and it's interesting too, you bring up I-70 because at some time in the early analysis of the smile, what's known as the smiley face killings, there was a tie-in to, I think, the I-70. Like they thought that somebody attached to that freeway was going between Minnesota, you know, Wisconsin,
right,
Pittsburgh, all those places. But that it's much broader than that.
And perhaps I mean, the bodies being disposed in water is a way of recognizing each other for these people.
Perhaps, you know, there might be some copycat thing going on. I think there was some copycat things happening. There was a young girl who was dumped in the river in Sacramento that Jim and I talked about. We thought was a copycat type death, even though it wasn't a young man, you know. But, I mean...
Well, that raises an interesting question because, I mean, obviously this is focused on men, but have there been any similar kinds of deaths involving women as well?
There was one that I thought of was this killer out of Truth and Consequences. He was called the Death Box Killer or the Happy Box Killer, where he would go to the same bar and he had women who would help him drug and then abduct these women and torture them in some kind of torture chamber. And they don't know how many, and then he would bury the bodies in the desert. They don't know the totality of how many he killed. I wish I could remember his name.
There are a few women cases. There is no doubt. There's one here in Athens, Georgia. And it was a student at the University of Georgia in Athens. And she disappeared on the way home from the library. And she was found like 2 days later in a creek nearby, and she had no sexual assault, no trauma, and that her cause of death was an overdose of Robitussin. I'm not kidding. And her cause of death was hypothermia, not drowning.
Have there been any guys that you would say that they might have had a close call?
Oh, yeah.
Oh yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, I get. There's a yeah. Go ahead, Jim. Sorry.
No. You go ahead. I was. There's probably been, off the top of my head, probably been 10 I can think of, and this is all over the country. In fact, there's one man here. I won't even mention his name, but he was a student here at one of the main colleges. He was an engineer, and he vanished after leaving a frat party. This is 3 years ago. And he was found, and he was found on the train tracks. Had severe trauma, but he has no recollection for 60 hours. He never found his phone. He had his wallet. A lot of strange things. That how he was found was that they were pinging his phone, and they were able to. It led them to that area, but they never found the phone.
Wasn't there a guy, I think, was it Oregon or California? It was earlier this year. He disappeared from a ski resort.
Yeah.
And he showed up somewhere else with no memory of how he got there.
California.
Yeah.
Yeah. He said he was drugged, but I don't know if that was connected or not.
I did include in the documentary that one guy out of Boston who was drugged and then was found in a tunnel underneath the roadway. Do you remember that? That was a case that Jim told me about. But so that was one guy who probably got away. The guy who was the serial killer, I'm trying to remember his name, was David Parker Ray, known as the Toy Box Killer. They think he might have killed between 40 and 60 women. So, you know, when they find people who are doing this type of murder, they're going to find, yeah. I mean, there's serial killers are out there, I can assure you. And I would encourage your listeners to be very aware of their drinks. And just because you're a man doesn't mean you can't have your drink spiked. But there was a couple cases, and the names I can't remember, but there was a guy who wrote something on one of the message boards, I think on Web Sleuth, who told his story about how an older guy came up to him, got real friendly, and he thought maybe that his drink was spiked, but he felt like he was getting profiled. You know, the guy kept asking him questions, who are you here with, you know, this kind of thing. And so I think that that's kind of the dynamic that happens in some of these bars. Is these young men don't know what's happening, that somebody's, you know, trying to suss them out, figure out who they are, you know. And there hasn't been anything like you know, The Silence of the Lambs, where somebody famous has gotten abducted. And I think that that's somewhat, there's another police car. It must be a huge accident.
What about the guy in Boston, though, who was out on 420 and they found him in the walls of the tunnel?
Yeah, that's the guy I was talking about. I can't remember his name. But
not even mentioned his name.
And he went to court and he said, just be careful, watch your drink and don't get drugged. Don't get your drink spiked. He didn't look like he was guilty. He didn't feel guilty about anything. He was like, sorry, judge, I don't know what happened.
You know? Yeah, they arrested him immediately when he was rescued. And as soon as they rescued him, they arrested him, and then he immediately passed out. He had to be rescued inside of a tunnel. He couldn't even get out. He was having to yell for the police officers to even hear him. He had no recollection of how he got there. Yep.
And this just shows that there's some kind of drugging happened, whether it's GHB or roofies or Hypnol. You know, these people are being drugged. There were a couple guys, and this is covered in case studies in forensic drowning. There was a couple guys who got drugged and ended up in the hospital and couldn't remember. I think one lived and the other didn't. I can't remember the name of their story, but that kind of thing was covered. And there was also stories within case studies in forensic drowning of young men being stalked. You know, there was a guy telling a story. He thought he saw a truck following him and he had to run, you know. So there's a lot of sketchy stories of, you know, people who didn't get killed.
One of the guys of the California Five that we were talking about in San Francisco told his family members on the phone, I think two guys are following me. Yep. They've never found him.
Mm. It was the same out of the case out of Thailand, whose brother I talked to. I can't remember his name, but it's the same thing. I'm being followed. My drink was spiked. And then he was found in water.
Whoa. I'm kind of ignorant of a lot of forensics, but is it like very efficient to, throw someone in water? Will that erase a lot of like, you know, any DNA evidence, or would it be efficient to someone?
I would think so. I think that the water is, you know, does erase things. I heard it doesn't get rid of fingerprints entirely, but it also, I think it's confusing authorities. They don't know how these bodies got there. The people actually come to the conclusion they're drowned. I think that that's the current law enforcement position on all these deaths, is they are accidental drownings. And, you know, that's just hogwash. It's nonsense. But
you bring that up. That's a very important point about law enforcement and how they handle a crime scene compared to when someone's found in the water. Because when someone's found in water, it is a recovery. It is not a crime scene. Very little evidence is found or looked for by the police. They don't look at it as a crime scene. They look at it as an accident and want to, get the body out of the water as fast as possible.
No, that's a very good point, because they're not. Yeah, they're not looking at it as a murder at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's something about the geography of these deaths is like. There's hot spots, but you know, in some places there's not as many. So I don't think the cops have really keyed in. And there are other researchers have kind of come in and looked at these deaths from a very specific or small geographic region. There's a guy out of Manchester. They call these types of deaths in Manchester the pusher. There was Elise Soper who talked about the Boston death. She wrote an article on Cryptid Antiquarian. And she was, you know, a blogger, but that article blew up at 2,000, 3,000 comments. Worth reading if you're a researcher, because all these people are adding their information onto her blog. And I did an interview with her, Elise Soper. You can check it out on my YouTube channel, William Ramsey Investigates. But so there are other people who are looking at it. The people trying to figure out, I think they realize that, you know, something is amiss, that these are not accidental deaths.
Gary J. Manchester.
Gary J. He's actually working on a documentary right now, so keep an eye on that. He was the one who told me about some of the deaths in Amsterdam, so he's looking at it from a different perspective. And there was a recent case there that just happened this year, a guy by the name of Blackburn, who walked out of a bar, you know, the same type of case. You know, walked out of a bar, young man, searched, looked in the locks that are all around Manchester, and then all of a sudden he just magically appeared in a pre-searched area.
You're talking about the geographical areas, and one of the things I was going to ask, I was thinking about as we're talking here, since, you know, there seems to be, and if there is some kind of occult significance, what about ley lines or places of power, that this could be something like that?
It's possible. I mean, I've talked to another ex-FBI agent, a guy by the name of John D'Souza, who says that these guys are being sacrificed to dark gods. That's really what's happening. That's a pretty, you know, an ex-FBI guy says that's what's happening. I have no evidence. I do have evidence that some of these people are occultists, what their purpose is. Like I said earlier, I've seen in whether it's Kenneth Anger or these other occultists, this type of bounding and drowning is happening. I've got other people I don't want to mention, but yeah, there's evidence that that's the truth. I put this, the King of Witches, a guy by the name of, there's two different witch groups. There was the Gardnerian and the other is the Alexandrian. And that Alexandrian, I put up a video of him performing this kind of witchcraft ritual where he's bounding people, and then they ritually drown this idol in water. You know, so why are they doing that?
Any kind of insight on that, Jim? Do you have anything to add to that?
Not really. I mean, I agree with what William's saying. It's just, you know, I don't know. I've seen evidence a lot with the moon, but as far as rituals, a lot of the stuff is very, it seems that way in some of the cases, just because it seems like dates are very important. The moon cycle in some cases, the end of the month, every month is always busy. That's another reason how you can tell something's going on. End of the month.
Halloween, New Year's,
Christmas, right? I mean, even the statistics back up what William just said too about, you know, there's been studies and about majority of the men who are found in water were during the winter months, and it starts in October up into Halloween all the way in through after New Year's. And pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's been bodies dumped on Christmas Day, kind of mockingly dumped. So that's happening.
Anthony Urena, who we were talking about in New York with the cars that we keep bringing it up. He was found on Christmas Day.
Yeah, in a puddle of water. His family said he was in like 3 feet of water on the other side of Manhattan. He was last seen on the eastern side and ended up down closer to Hoboken. There was a hot spot of all these bodies found around Hoboken.
The significance of the smiley face. I want to talk a little bit about this with you, William. The kind of the occult significance to that. Because normally when I think of occult symbols, I don't really think of the smiley face. But you do some interesting work in the documentary, kind of tying some things in.
Right. I mean, I think that it has an esoteric, you know, there's an exoteric and an esoteric meaning. I think that smiley face is a happy. But among the occult, I do believe that it represents... And you can see this in Moore's The Watchmen. This comedian starts off the thing. It's all just a big joke, which is a theme of kind of cruelly that the universe is a big joke. And these kind of chaos magicians. You see the smiley face featured in the kind of cult segment of Fight Club, you know, when they are doing their Operation Mayhem. So you see this all through, and I include that in the documentary. So you see it from a bunch of different angles. I believe that's what that signifies, and it's used. And it goes back into some of these occult-fluenced bands that go back to the acid house scene, and that's really where, you know, the gestation of the usage of that symbol comes from.
Does it have any antecedents in occultism?
Not to my knowledge. I've seen it used by Burroughs, and a lot of these guys are William Burroughs. He was a homosexual who believed in, like, a homosexual cult, and, you know... If you look at like some of the people I feature in the documentary, they're big Burroughs admirers.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, and I include it. It's almost in so many movies, the smiley face symbology. Even the most recent iteration of It included at the intro, one of the characters making a smiley face on a window pane. So it's, you know, and it's actually at the end of the first season of Stranger Things before the Demogorgon comes out. the smiley face is on a chair. I mean, it's all over the place. It's a very interesting moment. So the real thing you know, I saw the smiley face not just on Alan Moore stuff, but at the very intro to David Bowie's last work, which was, what was the name of his last album? It was Black Star.
Black Star.
At the very beginning of that video, go watch it. There's the smiley faces on the lapel of this, you know, astronaut that supposedly represents Bowie, Major Tom, right? So in that whole thing, that Black Star video is a masterwork of occultism, mocking Christ and Islam and all this stuff. You know, it's amazing. It's, and so the smiley face is there. It's there in very notable figures that use it.
Jim, we were talking earlier about, before we started the interview, about the Atlanta child murders. And since you're down there in Atlanta, we talk about some of the connections, reading a book about serial killers, and there was an interesting passage that was in it. But do you see any connection between that and because, you know, Wayne Williams, he was caught because he was trying to throw a body into the river.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's any connection, to be honest with you. Totally different, younger children. These are all pretty much African-American children. No, I don't. I personally don't see any connections.
Okay. Well, what would you say, gentlemen, about what guys can do to make sure that this doesn't happen to them, that they need to be as careful about what they're doing, just as women are careful?
Oh, for sure. Maybe even more these days. William, what do you think?
I'm sorry, I missed that last question. Can you say that again?
Well, what guys can do to be careful?
Oh, right. Well, you know, just the same thing women do. Travel together. Don't leave your friend behind drunk. Don't get drugged. Don't trust people who want to give you a ride. You know, some of these, like Scott Radel out of, what was it? Radel was one of the cases in either Minnesota or Minneapolis. They think there were guys traveling around literally hunting people. And that's what his father said. So, you know, you got to really be careful. And a lot of these murders have happened after events, whether it's a sporting event or a music event. One was Jimmy Slack, another one out of Pittsburgh, another case where they searched the area, didn't find his body, and then he showed up in the river. So you really got to be careful. And the younger men, college age, are a target. And I think that the thing is they don't realize it. They don't realize it generally that they could be a target for nefarious purposes. I do believe that, yeah. I mean, the Joey LeBute case is interesting for a lot of reasons, but what was happening that weekend was the Arnold Schwarzenegger weightlifting competition, or Mr. Universe something. I forgot the name of it. Mm-hmm. And I think that within that pool of people, you will probably find one of the SFK murderers. That would be my suspicion, because I think that these crimes are tied into the mobility of the modern age. And that's just my kind of suspicion about a lot of these cases, is somebody's traveling somewhere and leaving and not leaving a trace, you know? You got to really be careful. It's really dangerous out there. I don't know what, you know, I think that women can get drugged and men can get drugged too. Yeah, and there's a very strong correlation of drugging with all these cases, a lot of them, Jenkins, and just goes on and on.
What about, bring up while we're talking about this, but let's talk about the apps being used to meet and hook up with people.
Yeah, great.
About
great.
How it looks like a lot in the last 2 years, maybe, that a lot of victims being found in water are going to meet people, and people speculate they're hooking up with people on Grindr or these new apps that you can, for, you know, anonymous sex, and how men aren't even having to be violently abducted, that they're walking into a trap. Seems to be a new trick that's being used.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jim, because there's the cases, Dakota James and Joey LeBute are perfect examples. People are on their phone on hookup apps, you know. There was Barrett, also out of, is that Pennsylvania somewhere? Barrett was on his phone. So all these guys are on their phone, you know, tinkering around. But that's a great point.
Rob, was there anything that you wanted to ask? You're just kind of silently listening, so.
Yeah, well, like I said, I didn't know a lot of the intricacies of this case, so I was really looking forward to delving deeper into it. I mean, I want to thank you guys for coming on the show, first of all. And no, I need to actually go back and watch the video because I haven't had a chance, and now I'm much more intrigued.
There's a lot more cases, I think, than the public knows.
Yeah, I was under the impression that it was...
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, Gilbertson and Gannon wrote that first book, but they kind of did... You know, I called Gilbertson five times when I was making the documentary. I never was able to get a hold of Gannon. I should just call him, but, you know, there's a space there that, you know, dropped off with the researchers. So there's a really good website, Drowning at the River's Edge. Is that right, Jim? That one is
Footprints at the River's Footprints. Edge.
Thank you. So there's a lot of cases out of that, but you know, it's still happening. You know, it's still this phenomenon still taking place. There's no doubt about it. So I think I was hoping the documentary would show that it's a much larger issue than the public is aware of.
I've always heard about evidence on the dark web about this. Has there been any specific cases about, like, where, I don't know, maybe these rumors and maybe these murders have been put on the dark web, or the planning has been put on the dark web, or?
I mean, I speculated about that. Jim, you want to talk about that?
I've heard people speculate about it. I've never seen it, but I'm not very not into that. I don't really. Maybe, you know, I get it has to be somewhere online where these people are learning this, because there's too many. It's not just coincidences. You know, you were talking about how many killers, but, you know, there are many cases in the past few years where there are multiple victims on the same night, same different states, different countries. So, you know, I know to answer that is maybe, but I don't know anything about it.
Sure.
You know, I did cover in the documentary this kind of water torture that takes place within some of these kind of kinky, like fetish sites and stuff like that. So I do think that there's some kind of underground on the web that exchanges this type of information. Whether these cases are being traded, I don't. There's no evidence that I could ever see that they were ever being filmed or anything like that. So I'm not aware of that.
Yeah. Scary stuff, gentlemen. Very scary. No,
it's happening, man. It's really bad.
And William, you sent me not too long ago, actually this weekend, you sent me that there was another case of a young man that just disappeared.
Right. That was one in Illinois. That was an Illinois case. His name was Kyle Rogers out of Belvedere, Illinois, at a concert, went to a bar, went for a walk, found dead in water a week later. So that's a recent one. There's Charlie Pope. That was March 3rd, 2018, at a gay bar in Manchester called the Zombie Shack. There's Duncan Sim, disappeared in St. Andrews, Scotland. A lot of Scotland cases, actually. There was a lead singer, which I haven't determined what the story is, but he was found close to water. Yeah, that was Crying Rabbit or something like that.
Yeah, Frightened Rabbit.
Private Rabbit.
Scott Hutchinson. And interesting, no mention of the cause of death.
Yeah, nothing.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of these statements. One thing that's really common is, like, the media will just jump to a conclusion and say, there's no sign of foul play, or no, foul play wasn't suspected, or all this stuff. And it's like, these are really suspicious cases. How can you say that right away? And D'Souza actually had a very good talk about why these cases are being covered up for a variety of different reasons, because they don't want to panic the public. They don't want to panic. The colleges don't want to panic the parents that there's a problem. A lot of these guys are college students, you know, or post-college. Dakota James is a graduate student. They don't want to create a panic among the, you know, citizenry that there could be an issue. So a lot of these cases are, I mean, especially Boston. Could you imagine if Boston people came out and said, hey, there's a serial killer preying, or killers preying upon men.
Funny, in Boston. Funny, you should say that.
20 colleges there.
Right. There's a lot of colleges here in Nashville.
And some people have equated it or likened it to the mayor of Amityville when they're, you know, when Jaws was out in the water. You know, you don't want to panic people. There's a lot of money involved. You know, don't
Boston is absolutely, since all of the pressure from the public about these cases, they are absolutely keeping any case where a young man is found in water under wraps. They more so than any other place in America right now.
And the chief of police came out and denied that there. It was interesting that he would actually make a public statement, which I found fascinating. A recorded public statement. There's nothing to be afraid of. There's no serial killer in Boston, right? Or something to that effect. But yeah, there's the recent cases. There's probably 10 cases in the last 3 years, maybe. There's a lot of Indians recently. You know, a lot of people of Indian descent end up by the water. Yeah. Sriram Jayakumar was one. Yeah, it's just incredible. It's really, when you really study the cases and go into the reach of these types of cases, it's really disturbing.
Yes. Well, thank you guys so much for coming on. William, where can people get the film?
The film is available on Vimeo. You can watch it. You can either buy it or you can rent it for a week for like $5. It's long, vimeo.com, look up William Ramsey or The Smiley Face Killers. You can also, if you have a DVD, I just got the DVDs today from the manufacturer, so you can buy a DVD from my website, williamramseyinvestigates.com.
Okay, excellent. And guys, what's next for both of you on this and any other projects?
Well, I would rather not disclose, but cases are still talking about it. You know, they're still happening, still watching the cases. Well, Jim, what are you up to?
You know, I'm still working these cases here locally. I mean, hopefully there are going to be some stories coming in the next year. There are more and more and more people who are starting to open their eyes, and you know, I hope to expose to more people about what is happening. That's really my main goal. I mean, William's very talented. He did a great job with his documentary, and you know, our goal, one of the things we share is just to warn people, to tell people, so this doesn't happen to people, because you know, I strongly absolutely believe this is happening. And you know, if people just know what to look for and know that, you know what, you're not invincible at 20 years old. You know, you may be tough, but these people are much tougher.
Really cold-blooded. These are real cold-blooded. I have no doubt this phenomenon is taking place. And the victim, you don't want to be a victim of this type of crime. And the families, all to a T, have been destroyed because of the loss of the loved one at the prime of their life. So, you know, if you're a parent, tell your kid, you know, you're not invincible. You could potentially be drugged. There's some very nasty things happening out there.
Well, guys, thank you so much for coming on. This has been some real food for thought. Very interesting and very disturbing subject. So stay on the line for us, guys. We're going to close this section out, and we'll be right back on Conspiranormal. And we're back. That was an interesting interview.
There's a lot more to this than I thought there was.
Yes.
Like, as far as like, I didn't know it was an international phenomenon that they were looking at. I didn't know that there was literally hundreds of cases that they're looking into. I don't know if that makes me more into the idea that it's sort of a planned kinetic kind of thing, or if it makes me feel more like it's makes me lean a little more towards the statistical side of things. I definitely have a lot of stuff I want to look into now, though.
Because it's international and stuff?
Well, because it's international, yeah. And so widespread, and there's so many cases that maybe there's some other phenomena at work, or I mean, it might not be some nefarious, like, dark web, connected kind of thing, and maybe it's you know, like they even threw out there some sort of mass copycat type of thing, or I don't know. I don't, it could be anything, or just maybe it's just like a more of a modern like social movement in some kind of way. Like maybe it's just a real convenient way that's like recently been sparked by social dating sites and things like that, where it's just sort of arisen out of some collection of other elements. I don't know.
Yeah, they hinted at that too.
Yeah,
as right. far as like the communications.
That in the late 90s, that's when you started getting all the dating sites and all this kind of stuff started coming up.
Right.
Very nascent form, but it was there.
Whereas before, they were like, you had like a classified ad killers and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was going on, like the Craigslist killers stuff. And yeah, that was going on, I think, in Long Island around the same time. And actually, Tom and Jenny just talked about that on one of their last episodes. So, yeah, that's interesting too. It's a very, like I said before, very unsettling aspects to it. Just people disappearing, and also the fact that it could be a whole group of people that seems to be kind of coordinated. Almost like there's a very cult-like mentality to some of this as well, which we'll talk about that a little more later. But yeah, so if you had any thoughts on that, on this show,
it was real interesting. I would like to hear someone with a little more on the inside, or with a little more knowledge, detailed knowledge of the occult and practices and history, kind of delve into it and be able to pick apart some possible symbolism and stuff like that.
Right, right. Yeah, just kind of popped into my head while we were talking to William in the gym was about the ley line significance.
And why particular places.
Yeah, and when he mentioned Truth and Consequences, New Mexico, we both looked at each other, because does that figure prominently in the Downard stuff?
Yeah, yeah. It's on the 33rd, pretty close, I think, to the
33rd degree parallel. Yep. So there's all that too. And I believe Los Angeles is pretty close to that as well. That's a whole other can of worms, though. Yeah. I didn't want
maybe some synchro mystic stuff to this, you
some
know,
some secret mystic shit, man. So I did want to talk about Adam Parfrey a little bit. Had just kind of really been introduced by you to who he was, really, and then he passed away towards the beginning of this month at the age of 61.
Yeah.
So I kind of wanted to get you know, who was Parfrey? You know, what did he do?
Well, he was a publisher. We started Feral House, which has been like my favorite publisher for a long time. And the goal was really to publish things that were, you know, really kind of marginal, or push the limits of free speech, or wild, crazy ideas, or suppressed information. So, I mean, it was all over the place, from, you know, art to conspiracy theory to cultural movements and history, and, you know, it was just really influential in spreading a lot of ideas that kind of came to define a lot of the counterculture of the 90s and late 80s and then beyond, of course.
And he had a book called Apocalypse Culture.
Yeah, I believe that was the first one, and it was like it's a collection of kind of the craziest, most out there, obscene ideas that, you know, he kind of saw as a reflection of the chaos that, you know, we're living in now, or that the world was, our civilization was going into.
Right. Yeah. He also, what did he publish? Did he publish The King Kill 33 Degree? Did he do that?
Yeah, that was just available, you know, to the underground pretty much. And he first published it in Apocalypse Culture as a, you know, as the first mass publishing of that. And of course, that was probably most instrumental. And he also put other downer tracks in the follow up Apocalypse Culture 2, and then published the Chronicles of or Carnivals of Life and Death that we reviewed.
Okay, right.
But he was friends with a lot of the counterculture people of the late 80s and 90s, a lot of like the anti-PC backlash, Boyd Rice, a lot of people like that.
You talking about Boyd Rice, like the Satanist?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, and he was, I'm pretty sure Parfrey was friends with LaVey also, and Feral House published a few LaVey books, just all over the place, you know, in that kind of late 80s, early 90s counterculture.
And he also published the Unabomber, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, like Apocalypse Culture is a crazy book. There's all kinds of extremists, murder, serial killers, crazy conspiracy theories. I mean, it's just all over the place. Obscene art that had, you know, Supreme Court cases based on it, and just all the most out there ideas that were going on at the time.
Yeah. This some also real crazy stuff. And we were actually, you and I had talked about getting him on the show.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate.
There's a generation out there that's kind of disappearing.
Yes.
Because, you know, not too long before that, Brad Steiger, who was an author about various Fortiana subjects, he died at the age of, like, I think 82. And he had Art Bell before that, as we talked about before. So it always kind of comes in threes. Lauren Coleman is been putting some stuff up on Twilight Language about some of these deaths, all these researchers that have died.
I haven't looked at it since the last episode. I'm gonna have to check it out.
I'm gonna have to try to get Ken Thomas back on the show. We could talk a little bit about Parfrey, because I think him and Parfrey had a collaboration.
Yeah, they did the secret and suppressed books.
Yeah, this is it's important that we try to get some of these guys on.
Absolutely, and I'm just kind of worried
around forever.
Yeah, I'm worrying that, like, man, I feel like I was so dependent on Feral House, you know, and now it's like if they're not gonna continue, hopefully, you know, someone will be able to continue it with the same mission, but. You know, I don't know who can really take that place as far as like large publisher, as far as really nice books. I mean, you've seen some of the coffee table stuff they got. I mean, it's a great publisher, but hopefully someone will carry the torch.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. You know, there's a whole other younger generation coming up. So, did you guys hear about the school shooting in Santa Fe, Texas?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
This happened on Friday.
I don't hear news.
That's probably a good thing.
I get all my news here, actually, during the podcast.
That's probably a good thing that you did not hear about it. But once again, kid walks into a school and starts shooting. This happened on Friday, was that the 18th? May 18th. We're recording this on the 22nd.
They were not assault rifles, though, this time.
What was it?
I believe it was a shotgun.
Was it a shotgun?
Yeah.
So this was about what? Maybe like, I think they said like 13 kids or something?
I don't even know, man. I've got so burned out on it that I kind of tuned it out, to be honest.
So I thought I'd get you guys' thoughts on this article. It was said that he did this because a girl spurned him at school. And this had been all over Facebook. And Vice actually wrote an article about this. Now, actually, they caught the kid, so it's not he gave up, much like the one in Florida. So I'll read this, and I'll get you guys kind of thoughts on it. I love some of the language in here as well, too. You kind of pick up, you know, Vice is obvious political leanings. It's only been 4 days since a student opened fire on a Texas high school, killing 10 people and injuring 13 others, but a narrative is already emerging in the media. A girl had something to do with it. Sadie Rodriguez, a mother of one of the victims, says she was told secondhand by her other children that the alleged shooter, Demetrios Pagortsis, aggressively pursued her daughter, Shanna Fisher, before the attack. He kept making advances on her, and she repeatedly told him no, Rodriguez told Los Angeles Times reporters. Rodriguez said ultimately stood up to Pagortsis and publicly embarrassed him. A week later, he opens fire on everyone he didn't like, she said. But there are doubts about Rodriguez's claim, including reports from family friends. Matt Pierce, one of the journalists who wrote the Los Angeles Times story, tweeted, "They're saying that the mom was largely out of her daughter's life, and so they're asking how she would have learned details like that." But no matter its veracity, the claim has worked its way into the narrative of the attack. A BBC story about the Friday shooting at Santa Fe High School is headlined, "Shooter killed a girl who rejected him publicly the previous week." The Guardian ran with mother of victim says her daughter rejected Santa Fe suspect's advances. As for USA Today, Texas school shooting, gunman targeted my daughter because she rejected him, grieving mom says. It actually sends a chilling message to young women, which is, here's the cost of saying no, said CJ Pasco, an associate sociology professor at the University of Oregon who studies masculinity and sexuality in high school. What would be really great is if journalists would take that moment to perhaps highlight the expectations of masculinity for young men and to perhaps open a discussion about alternate ways to be a man. People are bombarded with the idea that so-called real men are dominant, competent, and heterosexually successful, explained Pasco. Those messages, which also suggest that women owe men their time and their bodies, can box individuals into an impossible ideal and leave them flailing or worse, lashing out. Research indicates that men who think they're not masculine enough might be more inclined to overcompensate. A 2013 study of more than 100 undergrads at a private university found that men who received feedback indicating that they were feminine tended to have a more negative view of homosexuality and more support for the Iraq War. They also tended to be more interested in buying an SUV. Okay. Threatened men, as in men who thought their masculinity was under attack, reported feeling more guilty, ashamed, upset, and hostile than unthreatened men, according to the study, which was headed by a Stanford University sociology professor. The worst thing for boys, for young men at least, what they tell me, is to be told that they're not a man, Pasco said. It doesn't allow them to be their whole selves. I think it leads to problems of male violence like the ones we're seeing right now. Mass shootings in the United States overwhelmingly committed by men are often linked to violence against women. This is at least the second recent shooting at an American school to be publicly connected with romantic rejection. In March, a 17-year-old Maryland student shot two classmates, including 16-year-old Jalen Willie, who had a prior relationship which recently ended with the shooter, according to a statement by local police. The media seized on that detail as the Associated Press and several publications that syndicate articles from the AP Wire Service promptly dubbed the shooter a lovesick teenager. But as Salon.com writer Amanda Marcotte pointed out on Twitter, there is nothing lovesick about believing a girl is your property and she should die rather than reject you. The lovesick term itself makes it seem as though being rejected is an illness, said Kirsten Gruys, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Nevada, Reno, who studied how college-age men see masculinity. We need to be teaching young men and boys that when their feelings are hurt, when they feel their love is not returned, that they have control over how they react. There are ways to react that are nonviolent and allow them to actually feel the full range of emotions that human beings feel. Royce went on, "We know that our culture makes masculinity in men more powerful and more important than femininity in women. However, even though there's an imbalance of power, that's such a huge problem that men as individuals have very narrow guidelines for what's considered masculine." So.
Where to start? that's... Okay, first of all, I'd like to say I don't care why he did it.
Right.
The fact that... I don't know how to put this. I've had my feelings hurt many of times in the past, and I didn't shoot anybody. I know hundreds of other people that have been spurned or rejected or whatever, and they didn't grab a shotgun and kill a bunch of people that weren't connected to it. Like this just, I don't know. This whole thing just seems, I don't know. It seems ridiculous. Like the, so, okay. So we need to teach young men that, if a girl rejects your advances, you shouldn't go out and shoot them. Like, we really need to teach that to people?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there should be responsibility laid at somebody else's feet here, not just the general population. And then that's what always happens in these cases. It's like, oh, it's because all of America teaches boys this, or because all of America teaches girls this. It's like, no, this dumbass kid just did something horrible. And there's probably probably some other thing going on in his life or his family or something that caused it. I don't know. I don't know why this keeps happening in our culture. And I'm sure that there is some cultural thing to it because it happens more here than other places, but I don't think that's it.
Agreed. Any thoughts on that, Sergio?
No, not really, but just how these things are being politicized. Now, obviously, yes, the majority of violence, the majority of murder, especially mass murder, serial killers like we've been talking about, they absolutely are men. And a lot of that probably does have a lot of cultural significance. However, the way that a lot of this stuff, it seems like as soon as it happens, becomes like part of this, the current discussion, battle of the sexes, whatever you want to call it, so soon, and becomes, you know, politicized, kind of bothers me, but whatever. I mean, I understand some of the critique, but it's, I don't know, man. It's almost like blaming, you know, it almost feels like the blame is spread so much, and yeah, people have so many ideas of how they want to reorganize an entire culture. And it's like,
that's what I'm saying.
How, yeah, you know, how are you supposed to do this? But I mean, then again, I don't know. I don't want to be too politically incorrect, but you know, there's biological basis for violence also. It is very cultural, but you know, there's a lot of darkness.
That's a good point. I think a lot of people want to shy away from the fact that this could be an instinctive biological thing left over from when we're running around.
We are primates
with clubs, I mean, like beating women over the head and dragging them off somewhere to try to create children. Like that was our history thousands of years ago, and we're dealing with the remnants and trying to act civilized on top of it. And, you know, there probably is. There's, you know, testosterone and various other chemicals and various, especially when you're a teenager, random things going through your head that, not to justify anything, but.
No, but there's terrible things within men. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But agreed. Is a cultural,
but again,
reorganization going to be able to stop that?
No. And also, again, not everybody goes out and reacts this way when these kind of things happen. Like, I've had my heart broken many times.
Yeah, it's called being civilized.
Right. Duh.
It's called being moral. It's what society is there for. But again, I don't know. The thing is, though, is I don't know how to quite articulate it. But, I mean, this kid's obviously a monster. And I'm not going to accept blame, you know, for being a man, for being, you know, pretty normative man. And I feel like it's just like ratcheting up this battle of the sexes, you know, right, as soon as, well, things like this happen.
And there is one kind of response. There is one shred to that I do kind of agree with. And it's sort of, it didn't directly, but I think there is always a lot of blame that should be laid at the parents' feet that isn't. You know, I can't imagine raising a child that would ever consider doing that, but would never go through with doing it. It would never like take it to that kind of extreme. You know, I don't have sons, but like, I still just think that If you raised a child that was like, that could openly communicate with you, they would come home and be like, yo, this girl did this and that. And, you know, you'd be able to talk it out with them. They wouldn't just like steal a shotgun and go to school and shoot a bunch of people. So I think maybe the disconnect, maybe why a lot of this stuff is happening is because there is a disconnect between parents and children. You know, we're letting PlayStations and cell phones and TVs raise our children. We don't have parents raising our children. And I think that that's probably a lot of it. I'm not blaming TV. I'm not blaming PlayStation. I'm not blaming cell phones. I'm directly blaming the parents. You know, talk to your kids once in a while.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe.
The other thing about the article, too, is that we don't even know if that story is even really true.
Right, because the mother was...
Yeah, it's just instantly being politicized into this.
Right. She made a statement of something that she had heard possibly second or third hand. She told the whatever media was there on the ground, and it got run with as a story and then gets posted all over Facebook. And so we have no real way of even knowing, unless the killer himself says it, and that had anything to do with the motivation of killing that girl.
Yeah, there are problems with, you know, male entitlement in our society. You just look at all the sexual violence. I mean, it's absolutely, yeah, it's terrible. But where is it in society's narrative that like it gets to that level? I mean, I don't know if that's, you know, oh, this is a consequence of, you know, I guess what they would call rape culture or something like that. Like, does this really, is this a consequence of that a mass murder? I mean, I don't know.
I do agree with the statement that, you know, there's, it's insulting to women when you say, oh, that, you know, if you tell a boy, oh, you run like a girl, where it's also, I think it's just as bad if you tell a boy like who hurts himself, a young boy, and he's crying, oh, be a man. I think it's just as damaging in both cases. And
one thing I want to bring up though also is that, you know, what's not recognized is in the male world too, growing up, is that no matter how much you try to, you know, make a male more sensitive, he's got to deal with other males, and that is where, you know, that's where it really goes down, and that's where people really get hardened and become the monsters, you know, I feel like. So
it's true. Well, there's a lot of aspects
that, you know, are in this, but I just feel like it's so politicized that, you know, even myself right now, I mean, it's like I feel like, oh shit, who's gonna hear this? And oh, everyone's gonna judge me.
Yeah, you want to be PC about it.
It's not a conversation that people can really have.
Well, you know, like look at like say like, you know, when I was,
and I'm not one of the, I'm absolutely not one of these like men's rights people or these types, you know, at all. Like
we're not in the Red Pill Club or whatever the hell that's called,
the manosphere.
But like you said though, there's other elements like that where, you know, when I was a teenager, I had a hard time with dating simply because I was sort of a sensitive guy. You know, I was into art and music.
Yeah, same here, man.
And, you know, I saw all these girls that I liked dating these, like, asshole macho dudes. Not to lay the blame on young women for being attracted to that kind of thing, but it's just a general truth. You know, a lot of women, I'm not going to say all, but a lot of women are attracted to that kind of macho mentality, and it breeds more of that macho mentality. So, but at the same time, you can't just like put out an edict and like, you know, run a news story saying that, oh, young girls should not be attracted to this anymore because it's going to start breeding serial killers.
You know, something interesting on that real quick. I remember what was the documentary about the cult, cult of that guru out in...
A Wild Wild Country?
Yes. Now, after that came out, I saw so many men posting on social media how strangely attracted they were to the woman who was the like de facto liaison leader. And so it was basically saying like, oh my God, you know, I'm attracted to this monster, domineering, mind controlling, violent person. And then at the same time, the
sounds
conversation,
like my ex-wife.
Well, at the same time, the conversation was on like, was on, you know, during the Me Too stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of women are attracted to monsters as well. Mm-hmm. And that has a play. Yeah. I mean, it, you know, not to.
And again, I think it goes way back to like ancient instinctual stuff that is just hard for us to override and overcome and even talk about.
But yeah, that's the thing is, but the conversation, I think the parameters of the conversation are being set up to where, you know, no one really feels comfortable and a lot of biological things can't be acknowledged because the culture is, you know, being held as way more important, which I think culture is very important. And I do believe in a lot of nurture over nature, but there is also a lot of nature, I think. But that's totally, I mean, it's becoming, you know, so politically incorrect that I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's it just everything becomes so muddled in our culture and our society. And everything has to have a cause. So, but we have the cause of Conspiranormal, and we have the cause of getting more money for our Patreon
and evicting the squirrels. Which they're gone now, by the way. I haven't seen any squirrel evidence in a while. Good. So
you don't hear any.
No. I think Molly got them all. God bless her.
That's good.
My little squirrel slayer.
Did you like my squirrel impression there?
That was pretty good. Yeah.
So tell everybody where they can find our Patreon, Rob.
Yeah, we do. We've got a lot of, I think, 12 now bonus episodes up there and more to come. A lot of great bonus content. You can find it at patreon.com/conspiranormal. And if you don't want to subscribe and you just want to do a one-time donation to help the show out, you can do that at our website at conspiranormal.com. And if you want to support the show but you don't want to spend any money, you can always just give us a good 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you listen and just tell your friends about us.
Absolutely. And next time, guys, we're going to talk to Rogan Razorwire, which we may or may not have already recorded like a week ago. Surfiel and I did. Or may have not.
May not have.
May or may not. And there's also going to be another section to that show as well. So stay tuned, guys, and we will talk to you next time on
Conspiranormal.